authors. And then there is Domingo Martinez. He worked as a part-time journalist and graphic designer for 15 years while writing stories about growing up in a Mexican-American family on the South Texas border. The result is a memoir titled The Boy Kings of Texas. Domingo Martinez joins me in the studio. I hope you will join us as well. Call us 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you. It's so good to see you.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for having me here.
And congratulations to you. You must be and have been over the moon.
That's a phrase that keeps getting spoken in relation to what's happened in the last few weeks. More than anything else, I've intimidated and frightened.
Intimidated because?
Robert Caro carries a very large amount of significance.
Anthony Shadid, the late Anthony Shadid.
And Applebaum. And
Catherine Boo. These are all people who've won Pulitzers. And you are in that list.
And I was managing a print shop up until about 6 months ago. So,
wow.
Yeah.
So it's really quite an honor.
Absolutely.
And the award is being announced when?
November 15th, I believe, in a ceremony in New York City.
National Book Award is really quite an honor to be nominated for.
Right.
And your book had such a circuitous route in even getting printed.
Absolutely. I certainly did not take any formal route in getting here. I worked on this book on the side while I tried to maintain a living. It was always my plan A to be a writer. I never called myself a writer. I was always a graphic designer or a printer, whatever I happened to be doing at the time to pay my bills. But the book was always incubating, sort of on the side. And I would write a story, or I would tell a story to a friend of mine, and I would notice that their ears would really prick up and tell me more about this particular detail. And I'd say, well, I could go a little bit more further detail, depending on your threshold of discomfort. And so that's why I knew I was onto something when I would write these stories and people would very much pay attention to that. When I tried my hand at like fiction or something else, people were pretty left unimpressed. But these stories really left an impression.
And where did you first have the first story published?
Published? That was actually quite recent. It was Epiphany Literary Journal out of New York also. After an extended period of attempts. I had a stack. I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea how to go about publishing. I was outside the academic system. I knew journalists. I knew people in publishing at the Seattle Times level, newspapers and local alternative news weeklies. But I didn't know the first step in getting a book published. And so I ultimately just used the internets and just started calling database, creating my own databases of possible agents, contacts. I mean, if I figured, we'll just start at the top. And I sent out my unsolicited manuscripts over and over and over again and got a lot of rejection slips in the mail until one time one person actually responded and said, you know, we like what you're doing here, but where have you published? And my answer was nowhere else.
That's always the first question
right.
to a brand new writer.
Right.
Where have you published?
You mean that's necessary?
Yeah, right.
So that person directed me to a directory on Amazon that I purchased and I sat on. And I just basically started in the A section, not really understanding how to read the messages they were saying. It's like, you know, we do not accept unsolicited public manuscripts. I'll just send them, two stories instead of the five that I usually do. And Ultimately, I made my way all the way to the E section. And then this was, of course, the second time I attempted. The first time I tried this, I think I made it to D before I kind of was discouraged. And then I tried it again like 3 or 4 years later. And for some reason, the stars were aligned this time, and the momentum just started. They found me in the slush pile. This gentleman named Jeffrey Gustafson from the who sort of volunteered on the staff of Epiphany, and he found it. He understood what I was trying to do with I was trying to bring the immigrant memoir a little bit further than the usual conventional. Stuff I grew up with, which didn't really appeal to me because it didn't speak to me, because I was second, kind of on the border of the third generation, and I was much more Americanized than Mexicanized, I guess I should say. And you know, I was of the John Hughes generation. You know, I was watching The Breakfast Club and Ferris Bueller's Day Off instead of, you know, listening to my grandmother's Mexican soap operas.
But your grandmother plays such an important part in this memoir.
She played a very important part in our lives. She was very much the dominating factor. In fact, I give her every amount of credit for bringing us to the doorstep of America. And towards the end of the book, I actually describe her as like I use the whole Moses metaphor, where you know he could come to the promised land, but he couldn't enter it. And it was kind of the same with Grandma. She brought us to America, but she just stopped there, and because it was just too frightening for her, and so she sort of maintained that same existence that she grew up with, which was brutal and very much based on a tremendous amount of just this velocity of work, you know, and it really meant a lot for her to be constantly being productive. And sometimes ethically questionable in regard to her choices and decisions, but she was a survivor, and that was kind of the point. You know, she was going to survive, she was going to thrive, and her family was going to thrive at any and all costs.
What about your mother and father?
That's actually where the complication starts. My mother was not Mexican. She was of a European ancestry, though she lived in Brownsville and she spoke Spanish fluently. She married my father when she was 16 years old. My father was 19. He had just graduated high school and Vietnam was raging. Two or three of his cousins had been drafted and Dad was terrified of being drafted. And at the time, if you were married, you went for he was 1A as a Mexican-American in a barrio. And freshly graduated, his number was up. And so he deduced that if he got married and started having children, he would soon descend those rungs.
And that's what he did.
That's precisely what he did. And so he was 4F in a matter of like 3 years.
How many children?
When they finished that first run, I numbered number five. There was a double thing going on there. It was primarily, you know, to kind of reduce his status, but also because he wanted a boy. And the first three children they had were my three oldest sisters, and then my older brother Dan came along, and so Mom was kind of allowed, like, I don't know, a period of about 6 months of rest, and then I came along.
And you were the last?
Yes. Ah. Well, and then there was an oops baby 13 years later, my little brother Derek.
Wow.
Who has endured a number of parents, let's just say, because there was so much of a distance in age that we all kind of took on a role of parenting.
Of course. Yeah. How did your father support you?
My grandfather had originally, he came back from the Korean War. He had been a private in the trucking pool in Korea. And when he came back to America, he used his GI money to start a trucking business. And he became the sort of the patriarch of the barrio. It was his barrio that he met my grandmother in the tomato fields Matamoros or Brownsville. She was never quite specific as to, you know, what side of the border they were on. It must have been Matamoros because he granted her citizenship. So logic would say that he was working out there too. And he had a fleet of trucks that he had hired all his brothers to work. And so he met Grandma. And at this point, she had been a widow for a while because she also got married when she was about 16 years old. And but her husband was a what they call a coyote. He was a smuggler. Worked both sides of the river, and he was successful enough to be on the radar of the Texas Rangers, who, according to family lore, put an illegal bounty out on him, and because they couldn't catch him. And so one day he walked into a Mexican bar in Matamoros, and the bartender shot him. He was 19 years old, and he was just flat out murdered. And that kind of set off a series of events. Also, he was shot multiple times, and so it was a pretty gruesome sight. They did take him to a hospital, and word got to his father. But they didn't tell him that he was dead. And so when he gets to the hospital, he's expecting to see his son, you know, in surgery or something. And instead, he sees like a carcass, and then he has a heart attack and dies right there in the same room. And so my grandmother is then all of a sudden left alone at about 16, 17 years old with a child, 10-month-old baby. And you know, my dad never met his father, and so Grandma had to kind of take care of Dad all by herself, and that's where she ended up on work in the tomato fields by herself.
Domingo Martinez, his new book, nominated for the National Book Award, is called The Boy Kings of Texas, a Memoir.
Diane Wayne continues in a moment here on WAMU 88.5. Good afternoon, I'm Elliot Francis. Tonight at 11, join us as Lean and Hungry Theater presents their adaptation of Shakespeare's classic play, Macbeth. Set in modern-day D.C., this version recasts Shakespeare's characters in the White House and in the surrounding area with modern journalists and breaking news. That's Lean and Hungry Theater's adaptation of Macbeth, tonight at 11, here on WAMU 88.5.
For many people, nutmeg is the aroma of the holidays.
I mean, the minute the lid came off, you'd smell it right away.
But this beloved spice has an unspeakable past.
This tale does not have a happy ending at all. Quite horrifying, actually.
I'm Steve Inskeep. Nutmeg's Heart of Darkness on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Weekdays from 5 to 10 a.m. on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the 495 Express Lanes, now open, offering a commute option between the Springfield Interchange and the Dulles Toll Road on the Capitol Beltway. More at 495expresslanes.com.
And welcome back. A National Book Award nominee, Domingo Martinez, is with me. He was also a nominee for the Pushcart Award. His new memoir is titled The Boy Kings of Texas. And Domingo, before the break, you were talking about your grandmother and the fact that she was just left by herself at age 15, 16, and you have a portion there to read for us.
I do. Grandma was widowed with a 10-month-old child before she turned 18. For 3 years, Grandma was grateful to be picking cotton and tomatoes for a living with her son strapped to her waist when she met Pablo Rubio Jr., my grandpa, about the time she was 21. She was accustomed to hard work, and she could keep up with the men working the field. Pablo Rubio Jr. drove the delivery trucks, had just come back from the Korean War where he had been a private in the trucking pool. This was a rough time for Grandma. She was the very definition of butch, though they didn't have time for fancy things like definitions in the tomato fields. She felt tougher than the young men, and far superior to the women who were expected to pick less and carry smaller burdens. She was competitive and mean, and would proudly get into fistfights with the young bucks who'd be surprised at how hard she could hit like a man. And young Mingo, at age 4, could do nothing but watch while his mother got into dusty, dirty entanglements with teenage boys who would initially humor her in a slap fight, but would then realize she meant business, and that she could punch and kick and scratch like the rest of them, and they'd end up sprawled in the dirt in a real fight, and she'd hold her own. Apparently, Pablo Ribu Jr. found this enchanting. He was bewitched by the siren of the tomato fields, and he paid her court in the manner worthy of their station. They had more than their share of romps behind the trunk, when no one was looking, or sometimes where people were. You take love where you can get it, in the tomato fields.
And that's what began
right.
their extraordinary relationship.
It was very Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor.
They were truly enthralled with one another.
Absolutely, and very volatile at times.
Now, there is a song that you write about in the prologue of your book. You translate the words of a song. It's titled El Rey, right. The King, by José Alfredo Jiménez. Let's listen to it.
Yo sé bien que estoy afuera, pero el día que yo me muera, sé que tendrás que llorar.
Llorar y llorar, llorar y llorar.
Dirás que no me quisiste, pero vas a estar muy triste, y así te vas a quedar. Con dinero y sin dinero, hago siempre lo que quiero, y mi palabra es la ley. No tengo trono ni reina, ni nadie que me comprenda, pero sigo siendo el rey.
Translate for me that last verse, because I gather it relates very much to the title of your book.
Oh, very much so. And that's a fantastic version, by the way. The last verse basically reads, I have neither a throne nor a queen, nor anyone that understands me, but I will keep on being the king. And the idea is that no matter what your circumstances are, that your honor and dignity surpasses anybody else's and is like the most important thing in the world. To a Mexican man from that part of the world, to the border male, it's a holdover. Well, actually, no, it's very much a part of the Latino institution, and the machismo institution, the Latino institution of machismo, which is not particular to Latinos. In fact, it's all over the world, but for some reason, it has that, you know, resounding O at the end, so it made it kind of a Latin thing, and so it's particular now to Latin culture, machismo. So what was really interesting about this whole book, or about this story, is that the most macho person in our life was my grandmother.
Exactly, exactly. What are your memories of your grandfather, and what do you speculate your grandmother might have had to do with his death?
My grandfather was an incredibly kind and generous man that we absolutely had. We didn't know him very well. He lived across the driveway, and he was very kind to us children. He loved children. But my grandmother, after having my father, I think was infertile. It's one of these things that, you know, in a Mexican Catholic community, you just don't talk about reproductive issues. So grandpa to us, was this incredibly kind and larger than life figure, because he was in charge. He was a patriarch, and we saw how other people deferred to him, and we saw how he was very much in control of everything. But he was very much a philanderer and a boozer also. This was the part that we didn't know about, because we were, you know, two or nine, or depending on, you know, the spectrum of children. And so Grandma was dealing with a lot of rage at a lot of his choices and his decisions. And in fact, recently I was speaking to my mother and my sisters about this, and my mom kind of indicated that she wasn't so much jealous. She just hated the fact that that Grandpa was spending the money doing other things rather than, you know, taking care of the household.
He was a diabetic.
He was diabetic, and he wouldn't take care of himself, which is pretty common in that environment. There's no real culture of preventative health care. Visits to the doctor, especially for something that you might not be suffering from, in the case of, you know, preventative care, it just doesn't exist. It's just not a part of the mentality. And in fact, I've had to kind of train myself to do that on my own.
He was a diabetic, and did she control the insulin?
I think it was sort of a shared thing. If I remember correctly, he had a bag full of needles, and I have distinct memories of her actually injecting
him.
It for him too. But he also would go for days on benders and not come back.
With his mistress
sometimes. It was not even an open secret. It was just open. And this was terribly humiliating to Grandma. And so she found, where every time she would see this person on the street or wherever, shopping somewhere, Grandma would go ballistic and chase her down with her very large blue car and chase her through the dirt roads of Brownsville, Texas. And my mom, and I don't remember this happening. Otherwise, I would have written about it. But my mother said recently, I think it was my mom or my father, that she actually set fire to the woman's car at some point, too. I mean, that's how hostile Grandma was to her.
Hostile Grandma.
Yeah.
One story that you speculate about is that your grandmother actually may have withheld his insulin.
That's
because
correct.
She was so angry
right.
about the mistress. Another story is in regard to the pharmacist.
Right. That's the contradiction that I was not able to clarify. That was a lot of the book is based on primarily on my memories. And interviews with like my brother and my immediate family. It was asking my grandmother if, you know, did you kill Grandpa? Would just not possible.
Would
it
be
right. It wouldn't have ended well.
Yeah.
But it was whispered about. My brother and Dan just kind of knew that something was not quite right about this. But the weeks leading up to Grandpa's death, he was certainly not taking care of himself. He was gone. There were days that he would come back with, you know, missing his shoes, completely intoxicated, just kind of drove his pickup and then would sit outside while Grandma threw things at him. And so it wasn't surprising that he ended up dead as a result of, you know, this behavior. But it was speculated, but never directly to her because, well, she could shoot you if she wanted to.
Domingo, are there any members of your family who would rather you hadn't written this book?
Absolutely. My concerns were primarily for my nuclear family, my immediate family. And I, living so far away from them and spending so much time working on this book, there was a real distance and
you spent
insulation.
15 years writing this.
I spent 15 years writing the book. I spent 20 years in Seattle. I
away from
tried
that.
To yes I did I ran away from Texas eventually I realized that I was sitting on this incredibly wealthy story, and I just labored at it for a very long time, doing revision after revision. And it, doing so, it really kept me insulated from what the impact was going to be when the story got out. I never thought it would be successful. I naively never thought it would actually, you know, play in Texas. I thought the story was going to be too rough for Texas. It was too truthful, for, especially for that part of the world. I thought I would, could slide it by and nobody would notice it in my family, but it was not the case. And
how did they react?
At first, it was I really hurt my father's feelings, especially because he's not the same person anymore. But my brother was a big advocate in the book because these memories are shared by both my brother and myself. Dan and I experienced life very much together, and so as we were, as adults, we were very much bonded by this sort of shared pain. And we would sit around. I mean, even with the distance between us, we'd call each other up and go, "Do you remember when that happened?" And then we would bounce the memories back and forth. Then he'd go, "No, that's wrong." You know, it didn't happen. Yeah, it didn't happen.
Yes, because each person in the family remembers differently.
Definitely. However, there was a sort of median, and I wrote the median, but between my brother Dan and myself, and which is again the person who I trusted the most. I still trust the most in life. Dan and I are. We've had a tremendous very difficult being brothers, and it's very difficult having gone through that also. So you compound the two, and you get memories like this.
Domingo Martinez, his new memoir titled "The Boy Kings of Texas," has been nominated for a National Book Award. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. You can join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. There's a custom that keeps turning up in your family, child swapping. What does that mean? Does it mean to trade children?
It wasn't in my nuclear family. We didn't do it, but it was certainly all surrounding us the whole way through. And it was usually with the poorer farming families that couldn't afford another mouth to feed, or in some cases the parents were too young and they were not ready to raise a child. So they would make arrangements with another, like, childless couple, or a couple who has two or three other children but wanted another baby for some reason. And they would it would be an agreement completely outside of any sort of legality, no oversight institution, no child protective services, no government. It was just an arrangement, sometimes financial, sometimes just trade, sometimes just an agreement. I can't raise this child. Would you take this child from me? And sometimes the children would have contact with their biological parents. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they wouldn't. But for the most part, it went completely ungoverned and without any real consequences. I mean, there was never, you know, the police called. It was never, there's very little in the way of child protective services in that part of the world. So it was a part of the culture.
Part of the culture, and part of perhaps why your book has drawn such attention. You talked about how your immediate family might have reacted to the book. Mm-hmm. What about the wider Mexican community?
I was recently invited back down to Brownsville, Texas, by a professor of sociology at University of Texas at Brownsville, Dr. Tony Zavaleta, who is himself kind of a local institution. And he read the I had a glowing review in Texas Monthly. He read it immediately, purchased a book, had it delivered to his house, and read it cover to cover and contacted me and said, "You know, I hated this book, but I loved it because it's exactly my story. And it's exactly the story of 90% of the kids in my classes. Let's talk about you coming home." And eventually, a couple of months later, I was invited to the Texas Book Fair in Austin, and I thought, and I just kind of thought, well, I'll just...
Why not?
I'll do the four-hour drive down to Brownsville. And it was incredibly well-received. People get it. This book, as tough as it is, as hard as the stories are, it's allowing a lot of people to be heard and seen for the first time in America, as a part of America, as certainly an insulated little nook at the bottom of Texas. But that was my emphasis, was as weird as this area is and as foreign as this is to everyone else in America, we're still a part of America. You know, we're still American citizens here, we're still behaving, but a lot of the choices are informed by sort of the old world suspicions of progress and integration. So there's that duality, and I explore that duality almost consistently in the form of like reinvention, personal reinvention, racial self-hatred. And my book is just completely permeated with that. And again, it's not individualistically particular to the Latino culture. A lot of people feel this that come from all over, very different parts of the world.
Domingo Martinez, The Boy Kings of Texas, is his National Book Award nominated memoir.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, State of the Labor Union. Protests shut down Hostess Cakes and threatens Walmart's Black Friday sales. Then at 1, novel, thriller, or biography, paperback, hardcover, or tablet, however you get your fix, we've got picks for everyone on your list. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.
Listening to WAMU 88.5 is easy. Turn on the radio and enjoy in-depth news and information programs that you can't find anywhere else. Supporting WAMU? Well, it's just as easy. Become a member or renew your support at 800-248-8850 or online at wamu.org/support. Then, turn on the radio and enjoy. You make a difference in what you hear, and thank you for your support. This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any phone calls.
And welcome back. We have many emails and many phone calls. We'll try to get to as many as we can. Here's one from Miguel, who says, I grew up in Brownsville in the 70s. I also had a grandfather with other women and drinking, and a similar grandmother who put up with it. Does Domingo think there is something in the water in Brownsville?
Well, there's certainly something in the water, but they're mostly heavy metals. It's mostly just
it's a culture.
It's the culture thing. It's again, the Institute of Machismo. Men can do as they please. The women are... I heard stories of somebody that lived a couple of doors down who actually would be out all night and then come home with his mistress to have his wife cook them both breakfast.
It was
just ridiculous like that. But it was endemic. It was acceptable behavior, and nobody questioned it.
Domingo, before we go on, what was the worst part of your childhood?
We only had one TV channel.
You're being very amusing here.
Thank you. There's so much, Diane, that I can't really zero in on one thing. If I had to, I'll admit to this. I didn't get my own. There was just way too many children, and we were all competing for the same resources, primarily my mother's attention and my father's as well sometimes.
Isn't that true of any large family?
Sure.
What's the difference here?
The difference would probably be that my brother and I were kind of thrown under the bus for the advancement of our sisters, and it was very clear. And it was more of a sublimated idealization of progress. My mother had control over my sister's future. My father wanted to keep my brother and myself to himself as labor and education and advancement and anything else. It just wasn't on his radar. And so we were forced labor. We weren't allowed to have the same sort of fun that my friends at school did on Saturdays. You know, they were allowed to sleep in, to watch television, etc., to be children. Dan and I were awoken at 7 o'clock. We were put to work, and we had no say so. I mean, we were just changing tire. We were out there doing maintenance on the decaying trucking business.
I would have thought that one of the worst stories you might have told was that in regard to a puppy who came to your home.
That story opens my book, and I think perfectly illustrates the levels of violence and survival intentions that my family had. My father brought home a ridiculously tiny little Chihuahua puppy for all his kids, and we were all. I mean, I think my oldest sister Sylvia was 10. And then you could sort of do the math as the declension there. And we all loved this dog very much. And it was an indoor dog. And but I kind of use the dog as a metaphor for our sort of vulnerability in the barrio. We were outsiders inside this.
Because you were light-skinned.
Because my mother was light-skinned, yes. And because we were, again, trying to advance. We were learning English. My sisters were bringing English home. We were speaking English at home with, you know, on the farm, and everyone else was related. We were not. Dad felt intimidated by this family, this barrio that we lived in. And so we had this tiny little puppy who we lived with for about a year or two. It was about 2 years old when it somehow escaped and it got torn to shreds by this dog pack that lived a few doors down.
A feral dog pack
that was pretty was based at like at one of Dad's, you know, step cousin's house, and they just ripped this dog apart, and in order to get revenge, my father, driving to work one day or the next morning after we found the dog and buried him, he shot every single dog on his way to the state highway, and it was such a display of macho-ness that it wasn't answered. There was no retaliation, because it was just like Dad really kind of out of nowhere sort of assuming his authority and saying, you know, we're not going to deal with this.
Yeah. All right, let's open the phones to Charlottesville, Virginia. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning. I'm so happy I was able to listen to this. First of all, Mr. Martinez, you absolutely deserve the nomination for the National Book Award. This is a wonderful book.
Thank you.
And the stories are gripping, but your writing is really remarkable. And I think in listening to your interview and in reading the book, what comes through is your love and compassion for people who are flawed and trying to understand why they are the way they are. I compare it to Angela's Ashes by Frank McCourt, and I thought that was a masterpiece, but yours is as well. I think it's wonderful.
Thank you very much. You're absolutely right about that level of compassion. The book, I think we mentioned that it's taken me about 15 years to write. When I first started writing this book in my early 20s, that compassion wasn't there. I had a lot
of anger.
I was very angry. I was a very bitter person because I didn't understand things. And as time went on, and as I kept doing the revision, I sort of started to kind of put the pieces together and put our whole family experience into the larger, broader context.
What happened when your mother forgot to pick you up from Sunday school?
There was no apology. There was I wasn't hurt. I wasn't bleeding. No broken bones. Get in the back of the car.
How long were you left?
A good 12 hours. It was kind of forgotten.
Did she ever tell you why?
No, it wasn't discussed. We don't discuss things. We never discuss things like that. Children were not included in adult conversations.
I understand that very well.
Yeah.
You describe your home as a, quote, emotional concentration camp.
Ruled with an iron fist by my grandfather, my grandmother primarily. My dad was, you know, the lieutenant. I don't know enough about military hierarchy. But it was, we dealt with each other through intimidation, humiliation primarily, and shame. That's how we communicated. We ridiculed each other. There's a story that my brother keeps telling, and he actually tears up when he tells it because he felt so betrayed. He had some kind of issues, you know, that boys get. And he felt that he couldn't go to my dad. And because he felt that if dad found out about it, dad would just ridicule him in front of all his, you know, all of dad's cousins, all his friends. And so he'd said he goes to my grandmother and asks her, you know, kind of in a sort of, you know, secret grandma, I need your help sort of manner. And she listens to him and nods her head and says, well, let me think about it. I think I have an ointment, or maybe you could pour, you know, motor oil on it, whatever, because that's kind of what they do. And she immediately turns around and tells my father which was exactly what Dan didn't want to happen. So my father does exactly what Dan was afraid he was going to do, and just turns around and, like, you know, points and laughs at him and ridicules him in front of our the rest of our family. And Dan just went absolutely ballistic at this point. I think he was 15 years old when this happened, and just that was the sort of situations that we just had to endure until we could get out of there.
So how did your father react to this book?
At first, he was incredibly, like I said, hurt and paranoid. He's like, no, those are family secrets. And my brother Dan, they've completely repaired the relationship. I will completely reinforce this fact. My father's a completely different man now. He's been sober now for over 22 years now. We're very protective of him. He's an incredibly lovable man who had suffered from an extreme case of PTSD that went completely undiagnosed. Mm-hmm. And the way he treated it was through, you know, medicinal herbs, old world magic, basically.
Alcohol.
Yes, that too. Which just, you know, increased the effects of his anxiety, and which coincidentally started immediately after my grandfather died. Dad has come to terms with this. My whole family has been incredibly supportive. In fact, we all descended upon the city of Austin. Woe be to them. And we had the first family gathering in over 12. I don't remember the last time that the whole family showed up to one place. Normally it's like, you know, we'll have Thanksgiving and, you know, a third of them will show up, or Christmas here, Christmas there. Everybody showed up. My mother and my stepfather in the same room as my father also. Everything, completely simpatico. We had a lovely time. I had not felt that sense of communion ever in my life.
Do you think you brought them together?
The book did. And the book is
Book is you.
It's their stories too. I cannot take full credit. And that's one of the problems of memoir that I never considered, is that, yes, it's my story, but my story is their story.
Of course.
And so yes.
To Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Greg, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you. I'm remembering Domingo sitting with my grandmother, who is from Poland, and connecting with her sitting outside, and wish I had heard perhaps stories from where she came from, but did not. But my admiration is also about the scripture that says the truth shall set you free, and then the adage that we're as sick as the secrets we keep. And when you tell this truth, I mean, as a gay man, I learned how to keep it a secret, how to hide that, and the damage that does. so I appreciate very much the willingness to bring forth the truth, even when it can be difficult, as you indicate, and cause tension in families.
Thank you very much for that. And yes, you're absolutely right. One of the devices that I used in writing this book was every time I blundered up against a hard memory, somewhere where I felt shame, some memory that I felt was difficult and felt that, you know, in the past I would really have to suppress that or deny that, I attacked that memory. Mm-hmm. And I flipped it open, I flipped it over, and I just started to understand why. And I wanted to know why that secret was there.
So, in fact, and I think this certainly happened to me, the writing becomes revelatory.
Absolutely.
It's not, you don't learn it until you've
actually, in that sense, the book was incredible. And I didn't want this to be the case, but it was incredibly therapeutic.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Did you ever have therapy?
Yes, and I can't wait to get back to it.
I understand that so well.
Thank you.
So well. Yeah. It's very helpful.
It is. It very much is.
All right, and to Mounds, Oklahoma. Good morning, David.
Good morning. I'll try to go fast. I just heard so many parallels to my own family growing up in a border town, which was actually San Diego, California. So a different area of this country, but certainly a lot of parallels. A very active great-grandmother who I heard stories of her managing a buckboard with horses and such. And my grandmother, her and her husband were exiled to this country during the Mexican Revolution because my grandfather was a postmaster in Monterrey, Mexico, and anybody with any kind of government position, of course, was exiled during the revolution. But I never met him. He died when my mother was only five. And so my grandmother raised six or seven children, I say six or seven because one of them passed away, by herself. And my mother, who married young the first time at 14, turned out to be a pedophile. Now, my father is an Anglo, so there's a little bit different component, but certainly a lot of parallels to the author's story. And what I wanted to say was that inspires me to not only read his book, but my aunt, who wrote a family history of our family, and I've yet to read that.
Mm-hmm.
So now I have two books to read. And finally, I will say about the song El Rey, I was right next to PBS on my television is a Spanish language channel. And as I was switching over to PBS, here was a movie on in Spanish titled El Rey. And I don't know if the song was based on the movie or the movie was based on the song, but as they rolled the credits, there was that song. So
that's great, David.
Aspect. So,
thanks for calling. Do you know that movie?
No, I don't. I never don't know it. I'll IMDb it when I get home.
But what David's story tells us is how prevalent these kinds of experiences are, no matter
where you come from.
You come from.
Absolutely. That's what I've been getting.
Tell us quickly about your sister's Mimi phase and what brought it to an end.
The Mimi, my sisters were... They were entering high school. They were between middle school and high school, and they were becoming sort of they were in their adolescent period, post adolescent, hitting puberty, and were becoming quite self aware. And I think they felt a level of intimidation themselves, and kind of subconsciously identified, you know, that anything Mexican was going to be something to be ashamed about. So they began, first of all, they dropped their names, Margarita and Maria, which we had actually, you know, we called them Marge and Mare, of course, because we were headed towards assimilation. But they didn't think that was enough, so they started calling each other simply Mimi. They began dressing in very fancy clothes, Jordache and Gloria Vanderbilt, which was, you know, fancy then. And... kind of took on they took on this completely different personalities in order to get through high school, and it lasted for quite some time, but until the point where they were forced to go off to California to pick grapes because my dad's business had kind of deteriorated.
Domingo Martinez, his new memoir, The Boy Kings of Texas, is one of five nominees for the National Book Award. I wish you all success.
Thank you so much, Diane.
And thank you for being here and telling this wonderful story. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rain.
Hi there, I'm Rebecca Shear, host of WAMU 88.5's Metro Connection, and welcome to Door to Door, our weekly trip around the region. Today, we visit Great Falls, Virginia, and Kingman Park in Northeast D.C.
Hi, my name is Bob Coomber. My wife and I have lived in Kingman Park for 3 years. Kingman Park is bounded on the east by the Anacostia River, on the north by Benning Road, on the south by East Capitol, and on the west, it's kind of hard to say, but it's either 19th Street, maybe 17th Street. Kingman Park is the only part of Ward 7 that is west of the river. It was built mostly in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Carl Sager was the developer. He built very similar houses throughout the blocks. There are slight differences among the houses, but it's a pretty consistent single residential feel. I like just the mixture of people here. You have a very strong population of people who are first generation who have lived here since the community's founding. And then you have an influx of a lot of young families. You have a lot of green space with Anacostia Park, Kingman Island, Heritage Island. It's kind of nice to be in a neighborhood that kind of has a suburban feel, but at the same time, you're right in the city. It's kind of a nice mix of the old and the new.
I am Karen Washburn. I am 62 years old, and I live in Great Falls, Virginia. Great Falls, as we know it today, is almost 18 square miles. It is a community of approximately 15,000 people. We have today this wonderful semi-rural community where large animals are quite welcome. Not everybody has horses, but a lot of people do. And we have an area where we have only single-family homes. The community of Great Falls was developed out of three farming communities. We had a community at Calvin Run, we had Forestville, and then we had Drainsville, and they have all been brought together under the umbrella of the new name Great Falls. Ironically, the actual Great Falls of the Potomac River have a McLean address. Along that riverfront, we have two very large parks. We have Great Falls National Park.